Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Way That I See It. And today it is The Way We See It. So I have the privilege today of interviewing somebody who actually used to be my coach. Now, people will be like, what? So back when I did my last competition, which I cannot believe was 10 years ago, I'm like, I retired from the old bikinis 10 years ago. And my very last prep coach was the fabulous and the famous, if you're in the fitness industry, Phil Graham. And so Phil and I kind of obviously connected through him being my coach and obviously stayed connected over the years, plugged into kind of his journey and kind of what he's done. And if I know so many of my podcast listeners are in the fitness and wellness space, and I just thought they needed to hear your personal story. They also need to hear your business story. And I know that you're going to have a ton of lessons and wisdom for them that I just know they're going to take away and really be able to use. So Phil, rather than me do you a disservice and try and introduce you and list out all the things, I'd love for you to just, I guess, share your elevator pitch on who you are, what you're about, and then I'm going to dig into some questions.
All right, cool. So this all goes back to whenever I think it's probably best telling you my whole backstory of how I've turned my whole chaos into order and how I'm ended up talking to you today. I was a very overweight kid when I was 16. And if you can imagine, every morning I used to go to school. I used to get a bus in. And before 8:45 in the morning, we would stop off at this local little coffee shop. And we would get an Ulster fry. An Ulster fry is bacon, eggs, black pudding, pita bread, potato bread. It's got more calories on it than you can even count, right? And I would have had that. I would have had a teapot of tea with sugar in it. We would have eaten that. And then we would have gone around to the local shop and bought a thing called Club Rock Shandy. I don't think you guys in the UK have it, but it's incredible. A Highland toffee bar. You definitely have Highland toffee bars, right? And Wham bars. You remember Wham bars? So I would have probably been about 2,500 calories deep before 9 a.m. All right. And this was how I started every single day. I didn't exercise. I didn't have a high value on health and fitness. And I remember going to school one day and my eyesight was blurry. And I really needed to go to the toilet. Like every time I went to the toilet, I needed to go again. So there was something like that felt wrong and felt off. And long story short, I said to my mom about it and she said, oh, it's some viral thing. A couple of days passed and it kept persisting. Went to the doctors and turned out I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Now, at that moment, I was told that I might go blind, I might go ill all the time, I might have kidney failure, I might lose an arm. And I remember walking down the kind of corridor to the diabetic nurse's kind of station and all these pictures on the wall of diabetic complications and people going blind and all this shit. It was very intimidating for a 16-year-old. And I remember sitting down with the diabetic nurse. And I remember the language that she used was very speculative around you might, you could, you could potentially, there's a chance of. None of it was certain, none of it was definite. And then I remember hearing about the topics: nutrition, exercise, lifestyle, medication, mindset. And literally overnight, I went from having no value in this stuff to becoming immersed in understanding it because that was essentially my way to survive. And I was told if I didn't get this stuff right, that my quality of life wouldn't be there. And I just point blank refused to accept that. So I had this immediate disruption of my life, and I had to do something about it because the only other thing to do was to essentially die young, all right, or go blind or have some kind of complication. So I invested myself heavily into understanding how the human body worked. And I said to myself, if I can understand how the human body works, then I can understand how my body works and I can manipulate things. I fell in love with exercise, eating good food. And I remember my first trip to the gym. It was the most hardcore bodybuilding gym in the world. You could smell the testosterone like 9 miles out, right? And I remember getting to the gym and there used to be this like pounding, like dance music, just from the inside. And you used to hear the dumbbells drop on the floor and grunts of bouncers and doormen and all this kind of stuff. And I remember walking in and you had to pay by putting money in the fridge in like a protein shaker cup. And the owner had like left it there and just put like £5 dues, pay in as you go, pay as you go. And I'd never seen like tin protein shakes before. Remember like the NitroTec tins and all this, like we have energy drinks now, but back then, whenever I was 16, didn't really have that.
It was
So
wild, yeah.
there was stuff like, Gatorade. And I was like, this is American stuff. And all this like nitro fuel. And I was like, what's inside this stuff? And it was like marketed like a battery pack, and I was just like, is this actually battery acid? So anyway, I started at the top of the gym in the recumbent bike and eventually made my way down to the bottom of the gym, fell in love with lifting weights. And while I was learning about nutrition and training, I really started to apply the stuff that I learned with exercise. My body shape changed. I started to look better. I started to feel better. I started to control my diabetes better. And then I got a real fascination with bodybuilding. And I was just like, okay, bodybuilding is my vehicle that I can use to keep accountable with my diabetes, improve my health. I was a young guy. I was going through the phases of, you know, building muscle, wanting to look better. And it was in stark contrast to how I was behaving before. So long story short, came to, you know, finishing up at school, and I decided that I wanted to be a dietitian. That was my dream. I was just so fascinated with the human body and nutrition and everything else. And then I went to study in Queen's University, Belfast for 7 years. I studied dietetics and food science and all that kind of stuff. And I used that knowledge on top of my training commitments and everything else to really do well in bodybuilding. And I did very, very well as a junior bodybuilder. I competed all over the world, got sponsored and all sorts. And people started to really notice the change in my shape and the level at which I was exercising. And they began to ask me for diet programs, training programs. And a lot of people came to me because they knew that I was at university. So there was like this seal of credibility of like, oh, he's got professional, you know, kudos behind him, but he's also demonstrating it. And then, you know, I remember 1 week I sold more nutrition training programs and made more in a week than I could as a top band by a dietitian. And that really was the start of me going, I can make money doing what I love. And I sort of clicked onto it, finished off university and, you know, did a couple of work placements in university, was told that I was unemployable. You know, I just did not like working for somebody else. I find it
I can relate. Most of my followers also have ADHD. So we can all probably relate to that one.
I find it very difficult. I remember I got sacked from one job because I was sleeping. I just did everything I could to clock watch, right? I didn't like it. So I realized that I was making this money doing something that I loved and I was learning about it. I would go home and read books about it. I would, in my spare time, absorb information about it. And the fact that I was getting paid for this was kind of cool and it felt great. So long story short, I was like one of the first online coaches in the UK before all this craziness kicked off. And at the same time, I developed this like real insight on there's no real good quality information for people with diabetes out there. So I committed to writing the world's first encyclopedia on diabetes and muscle building and wrote the world's first diabetic muscle and fitness guide, which still sells every day to this day.
I still have it.
Yeah, right.
I still have it. There you go.
I think every PT in like, you know, kind of like mid 2000s has it. And still like it still sells to this day. And it was a big turning point in my career because I realized that when I focused on impacting people one-to-one to one-to-many, that I could really shift my impact and really make a massive dent in the world. And I could also radically improve my own life whilst also improving that of others. So it was kind of that overarching philosophy and lesson that really then guided me towards the other things that I started doing. So I had this online PT business. I was speaking and educating other trainers. I was traveling and speaking all over the world. I used to write for a lot of the magazines and newspapers. I had my book. I had my diabetic community. We were selling online coaching in there. We were selling digital products. And then I kept getting asked by trainers, could you teach me how to do this thing in business? Could you teach me how to do this, how to do that? And I was like, well, I'm going to kind of teach you all the stuff that I've like risked to learn and spend a lot of money learning. So yeah, I can teach you, but I'm going to charge it. But it was this shift again from focusing on one-to-one client to one-to-many. And it's this shift that I talk about from being a coach to an entrepreneur, which is when you're coaching, you're very focused on the one-to-one element. When you're an entrepreneur, you're focused on the system that coaches the many. And through that, you can just have a far greater, deeper, wider impact. And it's really about building the infrastructure, the systems, the core message, the culture, and all the elements of that system, which, you know, a business is like an organism. It's like a community. There's so many different parts that feed each other and support each other. That it was really, you know, when I realized, look, I can have a far bigger impact here than the gym floor. So fast forward to today, it's a very sizable organization. We're probably the world's largest organization for fitness business growth and development. We have hundreds of clients, thousands of clients on our roster. We make millions in profit every single year. It's a chunky organization that all really stemmed from being diagnosed with diabetes. So, you know, when I look at my life, I wouldn't have taken that path if I hadn't have been diagnosed. And, you know, that's, I talk an awful lot about turning your chaos into order. But, you know, when you look at any event in your life that has been challenging or chaotic or very disruptive, as the saying goes, there's a silver lining in it. So it's, where does that lead you to? How does that force you to adapt? And what do you do with those adaptations that essentially will define you and create your current reality? So we can't often see that at the time when it happens, but, you know, having been through so many cycles of this, you know, you begin to realize that there is a predetermined theme to life, and knowing that and living inside that is automatically puts you in a position of winning daily, 24/7. So that's my story. And now I've got a business that I've got a great team with. I'm fairly removed from, I'm involved in just really the operational level and putting big decisions through and bits and pieces like that. And I've got complete control of my time, which is the most important thing.
100%.
So I've done that very young, and you know, there's a lot that I can share on that. I don't really know that the level that your audience is at from a business perspective or a wealth perspective, but there's a lot of strange.
I was going to ask you about that, some mindset shifts around wealth. So we can definitely dig into that. And actually, yeah, what's one of the things, just before I do that, I really loved about what you said about, you've kind of called it turning chaos into order. And if I look back at my life, and obviously, you know, some personal things about my life as well, there's been many times in my life where life has completely fallen apart and upside down. And I could have chosen in that moment to try and plod the same path and try and plug through as a changed person, but instead chose to transform, to shift. And actually, shift is one of my favorite words, to shift into that next level version of myself through using that experience as fuel. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, as a very much a bystander that I've been able to witness with you, is you talked about this, seeing the evolutions and the seasons of your business. And I do really believe that business is seasonal. And, you know, that reason, seasons, lifetime, like, I absolutely was born into this body. I do believe in kind of souls, and my soul is absolutely a teacher soul. I have that kind of need to share wisdom, need to pay it forward. But that's looked like many different things, right? That looked like going to university, then that looked like having a job, then moving into prep and fitness coaching as my first step, then into mindset, then into consultancy, then into a podcast. And, you know, everything sometimes has a season. So I'd love you, if it's possible, to distill, I guess, your journey. I mean, you kind of shared quite a lot of it there, but into maybe some of the kind of the key seasons. You talked about going from, you know, a coach to an entrepreneur. You know, what was after entrepreneur? Maybe that's the bit that I think most interesting.
I think it's important to look at it through the lens of, you know, everybody starts out as an employee, because essentially it's the easiest route, you know, to go and work for someone, to go and work on stack shelves and Sainsbury's, et cetera. And then you realize that that's not really the thing that you want to do. Some people might say, well, look, it's the easiest thing to do. There's no responsibility. I turn up, I do this and that. But, you know, if you've any, you know, kind of big drive or mission in life, you'll get to a point where you realize, like, hey, is this it? I don't want to go to work today. And the next level is then having the courage to go and build a business. And that requires you to build skills. It requires you to build processes, and it requires you to build beliefs around yourself and put yourself out to the world and essentially validate something that you sell. And typically the way that that is, you know, created, or people find that, especially in a service-based business, is if you look at the chaos of your life and then you look at the big wins in your life and the stark contrast, that's ultimately what shapes you. And you will have developed a series of philosophies and attitude around life in respect to those jumps. And out of that shift, you'll then have developed expertise as a result of the adoption to get from here to there. And whenever you do that, you package it up as a mechanism, and then you sell it. And you sell it, you know, initially one-to-one, then you build team and systems, and you sell it one-to-many, depending on whatever way you do it. And if you do that correctly, you'll then generate a system that generates cash. And you'll generate a system that generates enough cash to pay for the bills, leave surplus profit to pay for your lifestyle. And if you do it really right, you'll then have surplus profit that you can then use to enter a new game. And the new game is the wealth building game, right? So a lot of people try to build wealth when they haven't built the business. You can't build wealth until you build the system that feeds the wealth. So I always say to people that are in the earlier stages of growing a business that are talking about, where do I invest? Where do you, do I put money in the S&P, stocks, shares, pensions? This and that. You put money into skills that give you the ability to navigate the world better, sell more of your stuff. And then when you're like, you steer your money correctly and you build the business properly and you do a really good service and customers keep coming back and paying, then you develop surplus profit and you take that and you invest it into things that align with your investment philosophy. And that depends on a range of factors, your level of risk tolerance, what you're aligned with, what you stand for, what you stand against, tax efficiency, liquidity, cash flow, and capital appreciation. So those are the lenses that you need to look at investments through and what suits you at this current stage of your life. So if you're younger, you can afford higher risk over a longer period of time. If you're older, you want lower risk and you want higher returns, right? So it really depends where you're at. But understand that when you go through seasons of being an employee, building a business, generating the cash flow to build the wealth, and then when you get into the wealth phase, you're then like, you know, as Robert Kiyosaki calls it, an investor. So those are the stages that I feel every business owner should be going for. And, you know, you build a business, here's the lenses. You build a business to get into it and continue to do it and die in your treadmill because you love it that much. You build a business to sell it, and then you get money that you then roll into another game or you settle. Or you build a business and you build a leadership team and really good systems and really good leverageable models to allow you to reap the cash flow from it, exit it, and then invest into other things. And typically the third option is what most coaches will do. Coaches that operate at a very high level is that they will build a business that usually revolves around their name or them as the main sole proprietor. They'll build a team to run it without them. They'll then take their surplus cash and they'll invest that, and then they'll use that to build wealth for their family and recreate their lineage. On the other hand, if you're like an industry or tech, and you're building a software or whatever, and you're building it for a multiple and you're going to sell it one day, it's a very different approach. So I assume I'm probably going to be talking to a lot of lifestyle entrepreneurs, i.e. people that work from a laptop. So the third option or the first option is going to be the most relevant for you. That's essentially the seasons of the whole game. And you go through different emotions. You know, when you're self-employed, you're like high levels of fear. And you'll also take on high levels of risk because you don't really know what you're doing. And then you go into business, and then it's like, you know, high levels of risk, high levels of fear, high levels of volatility, especially in the startup phase. And then you go into the money phase. And if you haven't had money before, you got to learn how to respect it and you got to learn how to steward it. And then when you go into the wealth building game, you got to learn into like, how do I multiply the money that I made? So it goes from, in general, making money, generating shit tons of profit, and multiplying that profit. So you have to work your way through those games. And, you know, you're not really going to multiply your profits if you haven't really invested in yourself fully, you know, because like I said, you are your greatest sense of return, you know. So investing in the skill sets to be able to build a business that generates cash, and over time with the correct behaviors, patience, and vision, you'll then come to a point where your vision has surplus cash above and beyond the operational expenses that you then use to enter new games, do new things with, pay for lifestyles, or have a bigger reach, pay for family's impact, pay your parents' mortgage off, etc. So that's generally speaking the whole game, and there's different emotions that come with all of it. You know, a couple of big key lessons and big key points that are really important for everybody to kind of understand, because I kind of feel that there'll be a lot of people here that are, you know, at the level where they're still sub a million and they haven't made their first million yet. And, you know, a couple of lessons on this that are very important is you must have a vision that's bigger than your circumstance, a vision to pull you through. Number two is that you were never designed for full-time recreation. So please stop thinking that you're going to get your business to a point where you don't do anything, and you will have enough passive cash to do whatever the hell you want every day, go out and wine, dine, 69, whatever you want to call it, every day of the week, and essentially live a life like that. That gets very boring, very quick, and it's very unfulfilling. We all need a healthy amount of tension, and a healthy amount of tension relates to our purpose. So, you know, if you have anything that's in your current life right now that's too challenging, you'll get overwhelmed. If you have anything that's too supportive, it'll get too boring. So it's always about how can you find this balance between what's challenging and supportive throughout the course of your journey. Does that make sense? So if you've got that dialed in, you're constantly going to be growing. You're constantly going to be evolving. You're constantly going to be adapting. And that's exciting. You know, and it really takes somebody to go through the motions of making a shit ton of money to realize that that's not what they wanted, but it might have been the very thing that they were striving for at the start. So we work with a lot of coaches that come to us that just want to be rich. That's their only goal. They just want to be rich. Why? Because they had money issues whenever they were a kid. They were brought up in poverty, or they were brought up with tension around money. I know I certainly was. And you think that the only way to be safe is to have X. So you make it your goal to have X. And then you realize when you get to X, okay, I've got a family to look after. I've got my health to look after. I've got my relationships to look after. I've got my emotions and my past traumas and my chaos and everything else to account for. Who is actually calling the shots in my life? So whenever you look at building a business, never let your inner child run it. It's your grown, seasoned adult that has to grow it. Because if you let your inner child grow it, you'll end up building one-dimensional success. And one-dimensional success, we see it in various different realms. In fitness, it's just building a body, but being skint. It's building a body and not looking after your relationship. It's building a business, making loads of money, and having a horrendous relationship. It's building a business, making loads of money, and being an absolute miserable bastard, right? These are all real life examples of people that have gone in all in one area, and that's it. So I always talk about the real flex is multidimensional success. So, you know, show me how many people that have made millions of pounds, that have total control of their time, that have a great family, that have strong values, that are deep connected individuals that listen, that talk when they need to, that are educated, that are also healthy and fit, that aren't emotionally driven or triggered easily, are very self-aware. I mean, that really should be the goal. And that does not, you know, you don't need to be worth $10 million to savor that. You know, I can tell you, you know, from making a lot of money and getting a lot of it out of my system, that it's all bullshit, really, you know. There's certain things that you begin to like and normalize, but you lose value of things, right? So, you know,
like a good example is I was talking with a friend at the weekend, and look, we're not millionaires, but you know, multi six figure. And we were saying that it's funny because everybody thinks that when you can buy a Louis Vuitton bag every month, that you actually value it. I bought my first one and went, cool, done. Well, I was like, that's it, out of my system, right?
Do you want to know the real truth about materialistic things? And this is going to blow your audience's mind. So whenever you see a Ferrari on the road, whenever you were a kid, you used to go, whoa, look, a Ferrari, right? You used to go, wow. When you see one now, you still feel that little urge. I don't know about you, but I do anyway. You might see a handbag or might see a certain car and you go, wow, right? So I want everybody to think of this example. You never look at the driver. You look at the car, and you look at the car and you think to yourself, what would that be like for me? What would it be like to pull in front of all the childhood bullies that told me that I could never do it? What would it be like to pull into my community and have the girl of my dreams or the guy of my dreams look at me envious going, I want you, right? We never look at it from the perspective of who's that driver? But the driver gets into the car, seeing everybody look at the car, thinking everybody's looking at him. But the reality is it's a delusion, right? It's distortion. So when you buy a handbag, everybody's looking at the handbag and going, what would that look like on me? When you buy the watch, people are going, oh, that's a Rolex. I haven't got a Rolex. What would a Rolex look like on me? And what would it mean to me if I had one? Right? They're not looking at you and going, oh, who's the girl? You know, like whatever. So you might get the odd person that goes, oh, she must do well for herself. She's got this and this and this. But in their head, they're going, well, if I was to have that, what would it mean to me? So a lot of these things that we buy are symbols of wealth. And it is so important that you just buy things to keep yourself and the small people, which you can count on one hand, your friends and family, happy, versus going and buying things to impress people that you do not like. And we hear that saying quite a lot, but it plays so true.
But like you said, to your point, though, it's deeply subconscious. So the challenge is that even though we can sit here and say, right, don't buy loads of shit that you don't need, the truth is I actually personally felt like it was a rite of passage of needing to have that phase. And it was funny how you talked about money. You know, I'm a big fan of Robert Kiyosaki as well. But one of my things is I very much talk about the phases of money as like you learn how to earn money. Then you learn how to kind of hold money. So you learn how to have some savings and maybe pay down some debt. And then from that point, you learn how to kind of like make the money multiply. So whether that is investing in yourself or something else. And it's interesting in that earning phase. I think a lot of entrepreneurs get stuck in the earning phase because they're spending as fast as they're earning. So then the earning, like you say, becomes that frantic thing. And then that's where we get the distortion of thinking that the next goal or the next thing or the shiny thing is the next route. And actually, in my experience of transcending these stages, it's been about how I've shifted and how my self-worth has shifted and how my connection that you were talking about to your purpose and your mission has shifted in each stage of this. It's allowed that to grow. So that was such an interesting example about the car, how we're always, again, you know, people say, I don't care what other people think. You absolutely do. Like we absolutely do at every single level. It's just what we're making it mean. And I think that's such a great example of the car. If no one's ever looking at the driver thinking, oh, who's Dave in there? You know, they're thinking, how would that look at me? And I just think it was such a great example to show people, because I talk about money a lot on this podcast, kind of how somebody can play it back differently. You know, I call it earning, holding, and kind of receiving and turning, but how you just kind of refer to it so differently. I know that'll resonate on so many levels.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's very important. You can only understand that when you've got it out of your system. If you haven't got it out of your system and you haven't experienced it in real life, and your central nervous system actually hasn't felt it, touched it, seen it, owned it, it can be quite hard to comprehend. And anybody that does comprehend it and finds contentment in the most simplest things in life is very wealthy without needing to go there, you know? So the challenge is that we are, you know, the amount of people every single day going on social media, comparing themselves, validating themselves, trying to seek attention is quite poisonous. And you really, like, you know, one of my biggest secrets, because I don't spend a lot of time on social media. You may think I do, but I don't. I spend less than an hour a day on socials. And that has been a big superpower for me because I've kind of been very immune to the distractions. And, you know, one of the best questions you can ask yourself is, am I producing or am I consuming? And I have laws where I will only consume whenever I produce so much. And that really protects me. It de-risks me. And, you know, it's critical. You know, I want to have my life clean, energized, fresh. I want to clear my perspectives. It's impossible to live in, you know, absolute presence 24/7 unless you're Jesus, you know, and you're, you know, you're a fucking luminary. You know, you've just got too many, there's a lot of constructs and destructions. Yeah. You just need to work through them one by one. Every single day you'll have some kind of little trigger that gets you. And, you know, sometimes, like, you know, I see stuff in my day and I get triggered by it and I'm like, oh, where's that coming from? What's the emotional need behind that? And I went, I thought I dealt with you the other fucking week, you bastard. Right? You're still there.
I feel the same. I had a therapy session this morning. I was like, we've had this conversation 73 fucking times, but here we are again.
But, you know, if you think about, you know, how many days you've lived and relive that, you know, perspective over and over again, there's actually a considerable amount of experiences that you've wired. Because every time that you look at something through the lens of your older self, where you didn't correctly, you know, integrate an event, as you say, you're going to reinforce this muscle, right? So it's like, you know, like a bad habit when you're training and you end up overcompensating in something, and it just ends up with this growth that's not there. So you have to like really break that down. And I think having just a deep pause before, like, you know, if you are triggered by something, you stop and ask yourself why, right?
My problem is I ask myself why way too much. That's my level of self-awareness has become so vast that I find, you know, I'm in that stage right now where there's so much self-discovery as I reintegrate all the parts that I've kind of healed and big part of my trauma journey. And I think that can be a lot for people, is that, like you said, that self-awareness.
I've been through a lot of that. And, you know, I've done a considerable amount of work on myself. And I went through that phase of overanalyzing everything, thinking that other people should see it my way, blah, blah, blah. Like, then got into the paradox of why am I annoyed that I'm overthinking or overanalyzing this and I'm not being true to myself, and oh, I just need to journal it out. And then it just goes into this convoluted fucking head fuck. You know, there's one word that you really need to just commit to, and that's surrender. You know, so when you let go of all that, there's no meaning to any of it. You know, there doesn't need to be a story behind why you're always wanting to be self-aware. There doesn't need to be a story behind why you saw a picture and you were true. There doesn't need to be a story behind it. And you're so good at putting stories behind things and making your life complex, right? You know, that was a big thing for me. There doesn't need to be a story behind everything.
Nothing has meaning unless we give it meaning, right?
Yeah. And like sometimes that's easier said than done, because when we're used to thinking a certain way for 30 something years, you know, and usually using that to get what we want, then there's a seeking mechanism in it. And, you know, you got to learn to tame it. You know, I would rather be my own best friend than my own worst enemy. And that requires me to have a very firm relationship with myself, but also a very empathetic one. And empathy is not something that I was really good with in my younger years. I would always be my own worst enemy. You know, that comes from probably trying to hit targets in the weight room and or win competitions or whatever. But, you know, life is short. We're not here for a long time. And I really want to make the most out of it. But there does come a point where you have to let go, and everything doesn't need structure. I mean, you know, in building my business, I know that my traits of being hyper organized. I'm the kind of guy that, you know, if I come over to your house, what are we doing? What time? When? Who's going to be there? What do they work at? What's their background? Okay, and what are we doing after that? So, you know, that kind of skill set and trait is very good in business, because it's very analytical. What's happening next? What's going on? But it can be very intoxicating for other people. It can also be very crippling to yourself, because everything's like need to be organized and needs to have structure. And, you know, I have really been opening up the other side of me that's being like, go with the flow. Right. Stop focusing on doing, more focusing on being, and surrender to it. And
I'm in the early stages of that in my the next phase. And I was actually talking to my therapist about it. It's so interesting around. And I talk a lot about manifestation, obviously creation, manifestation, goal achievement. They're all the same thing, really. And I was talking about how if you've always manifested from a frantic place, from a survival place, from a need to be seen, or from a trauma wound, or from a it was something you needed to feel good enough. And then you stop because you actually have reintegrated, you've done your work, you feel good enough. When you are then trying to create or manifest or whatever, and you're trying to do it from this new energy, this new nervous system, this calmer part of you, it feels so alien. Yeah. And I'm in that phase right now of like where things feel new, so they feel hard.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. So when you're so used to building out of fear, scarcity, and status, and your accomplishments are linked to eradicating fear, survival, status, popularity, blah, blah, blah.
Most women.
You do it over and over and over and over and over again, right? You just condition it. So you got to know that this is all I know, and I'm going into terrain here that I haven't conquered. And creating from abundance is not about doing. It's about actually being open to receiving more than the doing. And there comes a part where, you know, you do enough doing to get you to a point where you then got resources, reputation, capacity, awareness, to then, like, sometimes you just got to wait to receive something rather than do something. And that's been a very, like, I know that sounds kind of...
No, it sounds very metaphysical. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'm not saying that you don't have to do, but I'm saying that you need to stop the endless striving of just real frantic urgency that's driven by fear of failure, fear of death, versus, like, stop and savor your breath. Like, you know, wealth is complex. Prosperity is simple. Prosperity is breathing. You're prosperous if you're breathing. And, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in life will be better when, I will be happy when, and you then end up getting the thing and it's not. So learning to really be content in the moment is a very important skill to build. And it will open the floodgates to seeing a lot more things, doing a lot more things. You know, and if you're going through a period of frustration or overwhelm or confusion or what's my next big thing, you know, a guiding note for everybody would be to focus on what's on the other end of that and lock onto that. I'm all great for manifesting and setting intentions and having faith and will, but I do believe that there's a large part of that where you got to do, you got to act.
Aligned action that feels good, that feels like it's on purpose, it's direction. What I'm not about is blind hustle culture, spinning your wheels, thinking that you've like, to your point, the constant need to do.
You know, again, I have thought processes on that. Show me anybody that's built an empire or extreme wealth without lacerations or scars on their back, right? There is an element of you have to work your balls off to win and come out on top over everybody else in the marketplace. You know, you got to remember that there's marketplace is your own internal value, and there's the value of you in the marketplace. You cannot manifest your way to being the number one in the industry if you're not prepared to take on a few battles, right? And you can't just magically expect everybody in your team to coordinate and know what to do. You are going to have to say no, offend people, make friends. You're going to have to, like, that's the realness of life. That's the real, like, these are, you know, it all serves you in the grand purpose, but know that some actions just aren't going to feel great. And I, you know, what you said there, doing stuff that feels good is definitely important, especially when it comes to big overarching decisions. I know that in the long run, this decision is going to do me the best and world of good, but in the intern, it is going to suck.
It's going to feel hella uncomfortable. Because then it's not new. If it's not uncomfortable, it's not new. And then it's not creating anything new.
Exactly. And you're also dealing with other people's emotions that have different views of the world that are going to conflict with yours. And you're going to get moany, yappy, annoying, argumentative people in your line of sight that you will need to know how to have patience with, how to hold space for, how to contend with, and how to do battle with. And, you know, when you look at the beauty of all that, like, you know, what's the beauty of conflict? The beauty of conflict is resolution. And if you can stand your own ground and have a stance and be able to articulate and challenge, be able to make decisions under pressure, I mean, you know, that feels good after the thing, right? So, yeah. There's a lot we could talk on that, but
oh yeah, we could talk for like 5 hours. I feel like I could just annotate a book. I'm like, I should have just bought a notebook. But I wanted to ask you, I actually had a question here that was, and you actually already said it. I was like, I'm gonna ask you what your superpower was, but you've already told us. So I guess what I wanted to ask you was if you could share, and I know it's impossible to distill this down, if you could share one major lesson or experience that really shifted the direct, and I know we've talked a lot about the early stages, but if there was one lesson or one experience that really kind of was one of those quantum shift moments, you know, that really moved you from going in this direction to this direction, or a moment or a lesson that you felt was one that, or one that maybe you've seen for, you know, countless numbers of clients, that when they can really grasp X, then they'll capture Y? Because I feel like you have, you know, a wealth of knowledge, and obviously you work with these incredible entrepreneurs and you've built an incredible business. Trying to distill what you know into a 30-minute podcast is pretty challenging. So if there was, I guess, a lesson that you see all the time, or something that for you stands out as one of the things that you've absolutely embodied, I'd love to know what it is.
That's a vast question, but I'll take a go at it. So the lesson is not to be afraid of dying. And if we look at every human's ultimate fear, it's fear of death or fear of humiliation or whatever. So I remember when I was a big meathead bodybuilder, and I actually recorded this lesson in the Generation Iron Netflix thing that's going to be coming out. I went on a boat in Mauritius just after I got married, and it was a rocky ocean where we're going to look at dolphins. And I remember diving into the ocean without the flip flops on, and you know, the like snorkel mask. And if you've ever inhaled salt water.
Yeah, it's horrendous. It
automatically makes you go bleh,
yeah,
right?
Sick, yeah.
Well, I was a 21 stone lean bodybuilder, so I was dense. I wasn't holding much like cushioning to like make me float. So I had to really swim. And it was in like whatever, Indian Ocean or whatever you call it, around Mauritius area. Please don't correct me in the geography, whatever it is.
No, you're right anyway. I'm pretty sure you are.
And I dived in and I got a big mouthful of water. And I remember going, couldn't breathe. And then I got, boom, a second wave hit me. Boom, couldn't breathe. And I was so fatigued from swimming. And a third wave hit me. And I literally remember suffocating, like drowning. And I had these goggles on, and there was all these beautiful dolphins underneath me and fucking killer whales. It was fucking majestic, right? And he's like, whatever. It was like something out of like Blue Ocean, right? And there was a very specific moment where I said to myself, stop struggling and surrender to all, right? Surrender to surviving. Because, you know, what was going through my mind was, what's going to happen when I die? What are people going to say? Who's going to be at my wedding? Who's going to... Blah, blah, blah. I started to get softer and softer and softer and softer and softer until it got to this. And it was one of the most blissful present moments of my existence, really. It was at the moment where I like did not identify with anything worldly or labels or meaning. It was just almost as that pure essence of just like ecstasy, light, whatever you want to call it. And I then got rescued. I got pulled out by a guy called Pascal. And I didn't really reflect on it until many, 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 many years later, where we were, you know, I was unpacking something about, like, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about this, and then ultimately worried about dying. And what's dying like? Oh, I've been there before. It's actually not that bad. Why am I worried about dying? So I'd really been to the point where I'd let go of living, per se. And it was incredibly blissful. So I kind of like thought to myself, well, if I was ever to die again, and that were to happen again, would I get that flash? And I'm talking, this flash was like a millisecond that lasted. There wasn't you couldn't put a time on it. And I was like, well, that wasn't that bad. So, you know, when you look at all the stuff in your life that is chaotic or challenging or new or whatever, it's, you know, ultimately there to serve you. You survived your worst days yet. And if you can know that every single event is growing you, evolving you, shaping you, retuning you, gearing you, then why worry? So I've realized that, you know, when I was building my business at the start, and you're frantic and you're worried about cash flow and you're worried about team and you're worried about letting go of control and you're worried about reputation, you worry about everything. But the worrying is what ultimately gets you to create, evolve, and whatever. And the challenge with that is that you then build this bias of, I need to worry to make money, or I need to be in trouble to make money. I need to go and get a hand grenade and just go kaboom, right? And, you know, I then kind of clocked on to the fact that, well, I don't really perform that well when I'm worrying. I perform well when I'm relaxed and when I'm calm and when I'm focused and I'm intentional, rather than building fear into the thing that I want to fucking do. So, I mean, yeah, two lessons. One, don't be afraid of dying. And two, stop worrying.
Yeah, I love that. And you're so right. I do my best work when I'm in flow. I create my best content. I speak my best things. I've written a whole course in half a day once because I was like, and it didn't come from when I was sat in my frantic fear and worry. And as someone who's had two near-death experiences, I can relate to your point about the flash. It literally feels like it's 10 minutes and it was like seconds, if that. So do you know what? I think there's something a lot of people will take from that. I think what I feel post-pandemic, we're still seeing a big shift in people's energy, a big shift in people reassessing and really thinking about who they want to be and what they want to do. And I know that in a cost of living crisis, and I say in inverted commas, not everyone's experiencing that, that actually there's a lot of worry and fear and propaganda right by the media. And I think actually just hearing what you've said just then shows us that we have the power in any situation to change how we feel about it and ultimately then change the outcome. So Phil, final question, how can people find you? You know, where can they plug into your stuff? Like, where can they, especially if they're a trainer and they want to grow?
Just go to phil-graham.com or fitnessentrepreneur.com. I launched a new personal podcast called Life in Your Terms. Check it out. And not hard to find.
Wonderful. And I will pop all those links in the show notes below. Phil, thank you so much for joining me. It was a nice little 10-year regroup on Zoom from the last time that we spoke properly. And yeah, thank you so much, everybody. That was the way that we see it.